I would be very excited if I found a grasshopper in the balcony, and my parents would put it in a jar for me to observe it. And I remember this as a child.
Welcome to another episode of Rewilding the World with me, Ben Goldsmith, and I'm here with Melpo Apostolidou from Cyprus. The last time I saw Melpo was in the beautiful wetlands at Limassol in Cyprus, and Melpo told me that she had been leading the effort to restore vultures to that island, and I was so excited to hear more, and we didn't have time, and so now here we are. Thank you, Melpo, for joining me.
Thank you for having me, and I'm really happy to talk about a topic that is very close to my heart.
Melpo, I was so happy to visit Cyprus. I'm co-founder of a little foundation called the Cyprus Environment Foundation, and they invited me there, and I came with my wife Jemima with no kids, and we had a lot of time to explore. And I had an impression that the island would be very heavily developed for tourism. We've got the British military bases and other things. And in fact, I found so much green space. I mean, the wetland is Limassol is enormous and humming with life, but also the interior of the island is full of green mountains and cedar trees and forests and the smells. And I was astonished that Cyprus has so much wild space left.
I think if you would have visited maybe 10 years ago, you would have this impression even more. I think it's maybe you're comparing it to something else, but it used to be better in terms of that, and it is changing. And it is a big battle that we are giving us as BirdLife Cyprus, an NGO operating in Cyprus, to maintain, preserve, and manage the few areas that have remained undisturbed and are important to wildlife. And Akrotiri is actually one of those areas that are very important for biodiversity.
Melpo, you grew up in Cyprus exploring the wild places, and presumably you grew up with a big love of nature and wildlife, and that's how you ended up working with BirdLife.
Yes, basically, I think I am who I am because of my parents. My dad is a hunter. It might sound odd, but I think it's because of him that I appreciated nature as a kid. And my parents allowed me to develop this love for wildlife and for the outdoors. In the first years of my life, I grew up in Athens, to be honest, and I remember going to school and picking up bags and taking them home and having them close to me while I was studying. And the next day, I would go back and release those, and I would get other bags, you know, so I don't keep them at home. And I would be very excited if I found a grasshopper in the balcony, and my parents would put it in a jar for me to observe it. And I remember this as a child. And it's something that it developed eventually. And I studied biology, and in a way, life guided me in doing what I'm doing. I always loved nature, and I always felt the need to protect those that don't have a voice, animals.
And BirdLife is a well-known organization globally. It's a huge federation of organizations around the world, and one of the most important pieces of architecture, I think, in the environmental movement. I met Martin Harper, the chief executive of BirdLife International, for coffee last week, and I was hugely impressed by what he told me that the BirdLife members are doing around the world. How many people are in BirdLife Cyprus, and what's the main piece of work that you're engaged in there?
Yes, at the moment we are 16 people at the office, and a lot of our work has to do with protecting Natura 2000 areas and the management of protected sites. Basically, there is a lot of pressure for development on the island that often has a negative impact on those areas, be it building on a catchment area of a wetland, or building renewable energy without a strategic plan for the whole island. And there is a great pressure for development, for casinos, housing, renewables. And it's a topic that takes up a lot of our time. We also work a lot on our anti-trapping campaign, the illegal killing of birds. We're working on anti-poisoning because there's a huge issue of poisoning of raptors on the island. I mean, the griffon vulture faces a great pressure of, you know, it might go extinct in the next 5 years if we don't reduce the use of poisoning. A lot of education as well among youngsters, schools, the public. So there is a variety and work on multiple levels to address issues that our environment is facing in Cyprus.
Melpa, you talked about illegal trapping and hunting of migratory birds. Cyprus is one of the most important stopovers for birds moving between Europe and Asia Minor down into Africa in the winter and back up. It's a big migratory bird flyway. So enormous numbers of birds stop on the island in the autumn time and in the spring. Hence, the island has a culture of trapping for sport and hunting and also for food, these migrating birds. How big a problem does that remain on the island, and how do you guys seek to address it?
Well, you're very correct. Because of this migration, there's also people are taking advantage of the migration of birds. So they do trap them either with mist nets or lime sticks. We are estimating that around 2 million birds die in Cyprus during that time. It is getting a bit better after a lot of work and lobbying and work on the ground and work with the authorities to minimize this illegal activity, because we are talking about a wildlife crime here.
Melpa, is the hunting principally a question of sport, or is it a question of hunting these birds for food? Because I've seen posts on social media of, for example, migrating raptors or flamingos or cranes or the birds that you wouldn't imagine people want to eat being shot or trapped and then piled in front of some guy dressed in camo for a video or a photo. Is it really a sport thing?
No, it's not a sport thing. We're talking about poaching. We're talking about an illegal activity. We're not talking about hunting as such. And they're mainly targeting songbirds. Shooting, we don't have that a lot in Cyprus. I wouldn't say that it is a significant issue, but trapping is, with lime sticks and nets. Basically, it's a business, because they do sell them illegally for food. It used to be a tradition, but not anymore. There are a few remaining people who continue to do that. And these people are probably known to the authorities. And they have a big range of other criminal activities in their portfolio. And trapping is just another activity, illegal activity that they're doing. We're talking about a lucrative business, a black market of birds. But there's also, of course, the element of the public that consumes these songbirds. Yeah, so when I said before that we're working on multiple levels, we are lobbying the politicians to enforce the law, because the law is very good and it does forbid this activity. But we're also working on awareness level to raise awareness among the public, so we reduce the demand as well of this of the consumption, basically, of the songbirds.
And curtailing demand, of course, has been really successful in other areas. As soon as China banned the import of ivory and the use of ivory and put strict penalties around that, along with a kind of cultural shift and Chinese celebrities pointing out the vulgarity and the immorality of using ivory, the demand slumped and elephant numbers are now rising for the first time in a very long time in Africa. So it really works to tackle the demand for this. There's a lot in the British press we read about hunting of and trapping of migrating birds in the Mediterranean. It's an issue of huge concern for bird lovers and nature lovers in Britain. I feel very reassured that BirdLife is working on this and that you say the practice is dying out. And what about the big wetland at Limassol, which I saw? I mean, it was huge, and I wasn't aware there was such a big wetland on the island. I'm told it's the biggest and the most important. I saw that they're using native cypress cattle for conservation grazing, and I saw all kinds of birds there. Tell me a little bit about that wetland.
So Agrodiri Peninsula that we visited together has a complex of wetlands. It includes a salt lake, some freshwater wetlands, and the marsh that we visited, and we have the cypress cattle there. So basically, the specific wetland, it's one of the few natural wetlands on the island, and well, traditionally it used to being grazed, and that died out in the last decades. And we had a project which was it was funded by Darwin. It's a funding instrument for overseas territories. And as part of that project, we tried to increase grazing in the area because it was being taken over by reeds, and that decreased the biodiversity of that wetland. And actually, it's a local breed of cattle that they're doing a fantastic job in grazing and trampling the reeds. Using them as a management tool, we managed to reduce the expansion of reeds in Agrodiri wetland, and we have seen an increase of key species breeding there. And it still needs work and management. It's not excellent, but we saw a big difference in the biodiversity before and after that project.
Well, I love my visit there. Melpo, I'd love to talk about two iconic species of cypress. The first is the monk seal. And I know you don't work directly yourself on monk seals, but I've become fascinated since I came to the island. I understand that 200 or 300 years ago, they were really numerous across the Mediterranean. These huge seals, 8 foot long, 8, 9 foot long. And they like to nest in little caves and things, but the early accounts say that there were significant numbers even on the open beaches of Cyprus in earlier centuries. So what's the status of the monk seal in the Eastern Mediterranean and around Cyprus? And do you have optimism that this species can regain something of its former abundance if we look after it carefully?
Yeah, like you said, it's not a species I have been greatly involved, but I know that it's one of the most threatened mammals in the Mediterranean. And there have been conservation efforts in the last year, and the results seem to be positive. And we have increase in nesting pairs. I think the conservation work is targeted in protecting the caves where they breed, and there are cameras that are monitoring them, and there's also a lot of work being done with fishermen to raise awareness. But I think we are at the beginning of these conservation efforts, and we have a long way still to go. There is, again, the pressure of development for tourism and the factor of disturbance in these sea caves that affects the species. And it's also an effort that has to be done across the Mediterranean, so it does not only depend on one country, like migratory birds, for example, or turtles, sea turtles.
I did a podcast episode not so long ago on the extraordinary recovery of marine abundance in an area of the Turkish Mediterranean coast where they've established a no-take zone. And what they found there was that as soon as the area was set off limits for commercial fishing, life started to come back. fish numbers increased and the monk seals were attracted back to the area in meaningful numbers. And what they found is that they're nesting in these small coves in the wintertime. But from time to time, the sea levels rise, especially during stormy weather, and the young seal pups were drowning. So they went into the coves and they established these little platforms, like a little concrete platform, which is higher up than what was there already. And they hugely increased the breeding success of the monk seals in this part of Turkey as a result of that. So I don't know whether that's something that's happening in Cyprus, but it strikes me that minimizing disturbance, protection of the key breeding areas, maybe the construction of these platforms and the establishment of marine protected areas in order to restore marine abundance is the pathway. Are these things happening to some degree or other in Cyprus?
Yes, there are conservation measures being implemented in Cyprus. If you're talking about the monk seal only, I'm not aware about if there are any issues with sea level rising and, you know, the need for platforms. But those examples of conservation measures helping species should be communicated. And what also needs to be communicated in this is that if we're implementing conservation measures now, we're saving money, because if we have to bring a species back after years, or having to address the impacts of climate change after, it will be more expensive. So the conservation measures being implemented now and being proactive is definitely beneficial.
Yeah, in building resilience for the whole island to some of the changes that are coming. The other iconic species I wanted to talk to you about, of course, are the vultures of Cyprus. And the first question I had for you is, which species of vultures were recorded in the past in Cyprus and in what kind of abundance? Because I was there for nearly a week, I didn't see a single vulture, but I probably didn't go to the right place. So I'd love to know, what was there before?
We had two species of vultures before. We had the Gyps fulvus, the griffon vulture, and the black vulture. The black vulture has gone extinct in Cyprus, I think, since the 50s. It was less abundant than the griffon vulture, of course. It went extinct possibly because of the extensive use of poison, and also disturbance or in their nesting sites in the forest, because they nest in, on trees. So currently we only have the griffon vulture, and on migration we have the Egyptian vulture, but that's very rare. It could be one individual every year. What we're trying to do now is save the griffon vulture and prevent its extinction. As an island, we started very late in addressing its threats. So we started maybe when the population was only 10 birds, which is, you know, almost a step before extinction. So we do have a long way to go still. We need to reduce the use of poison if we want to see the griffon vulture population thrive again.
So what are they using poison for? What? Because I'm not aware of predatory mammals on the island. I guess foxes. Are they poisoning foxes, badgers, or is it stray dogs?
Yeah, the target species is not the griffon vulture that falls a victim. The target species are mainly foxes and sometimes stray dogs. But poison baits are also used in human-human conflict. So if I'm a hunter and I want to hunt in that area, I might use poison so other hunters won't go there. So it's something that it's very widely used by hunters and also by farmers. And I'm definitely not saying that all hunters or all farmers do that. And actually, farmers and hunters have a critical role to play, because they're the ones that are impacted the most. The hunting dogs die from this illegal activity, and those people are the ones who report to us poisoning incidents. So they can also be the solution, and they do help to prevent further poisoning of wildlife.
What's the wild source of food for vultures historically? Because the, as far as I'm aware, the principal wild herbivore of the island is the Persian red deer or Persian fallow deer, and yet they no longer exist on the.
I think so.
So what food is available?
Probably the mouflon, the Cyprus mouflon as well, and the deer. But griffon vultures are very connected to human activity. So probably their numbers thrived when there was livestock farming activity on the island. And this is what they eat. And that's a great ecosystem service that they provide, as they can remove dead carcasses from the countryside. And this is exactly the ecosystem service that we need to restore.
Are the mouflons still present on the island?
Yes, of course, there are, but they're mostly in more forested areas. And vultures do not prefer eating mouflons. They will find livestock animals, goats and sheep, and they will feed on that. But there is a good population of mouflon on the island.
Melpa, what do you think is the carrying capacity for griffon vultures on Cyprus?
There was a study being done actually on that, and it is estimated that the carrying capacity of the island is 200 vultures.
And the current population now is?
Now it's the current population now is 29 birds. And from those birds, almost 25 are the Spanish birds that we brought from Spain to restock and boost the local population.
So how do you do that? How do you catch and sedate and transport a live adult vulture from Spain all the way to Cyprus? What's the process?
So the birds that we receive are birds that have entered rehabilitation centers and wildlife hospitals. So they're mostly, in their majority, juvenile birds that have been found either dehydrated or disoriented, or they might have a small fracture. So they enter the wildlife hospital in Spain. We collaborate with AMUSH. And our partner, the Vulture Conservation Foundation, coordinates all the procedure of the transport of birds. So birds are selected from those hospitals and are allocated to restocking projects across Europe. So not only Cyprus receives griffon vultures from Spain, but also other areas in Europe, like Sardinia. And when we get these birds, they are not sedated. They come through flights from Spain. And it's actually the first time that birds are traveling so far across Europe to reach Cyprus from Spain. They enter an acclimatization area here in the outskirts of Limassol, where they stay for a minimum of 6 months. And before the release, they're equipped with a GPS tag and a ring, so we can monitor their acclimatization to the island after they're free. And actually, it has been very successful, and we've seen that 10 years ago when we had another effort in bringing birds from Crete. And those birds, we saw that they did form pairs with the Cyprus birds, and we had chicks from those. And it's something we're doing again, because basically the poisoning incidents are taking us steps back, because every time that we increase the local population, we have an incident, we lose birds, and again and again. So the restocking effort adds to the whole conservation effort of boosting the population and supporting it. We need to invest and focus on anti-poisoning actions, investigation, awareness raising, collaboration with all the relevant authorities that are involved in the chain of custody for the investigation, and law enforcement, basically.
How does it make you feel, Melpa, when you take the boxes up to the top of the cliff and you open the gate and the vultures come out and they stand there for a while? I've seen the videos you sent me, and suddenly on those massive wings, they suddenly take flight. I mean, I was blown away watching it on my iPhone. I can't even imagine what it must have been like for you there in person, having orchestrated this yourself.
On the one hand, I feel the burden of responsibility heavy sometimes. Of course, I realize that it's not up to one person, of course, this effort. It's a big team behind all this effort. And on the other hand, I see it as these birds get a second chance in life by being rehabilitated and released back. It gives me hope, basically.
I feel the same. I think reintroduction of species or population reinforcements really are totemic, because you, in order to do them successfully, you have to bring the whole population with you. You need to create the conditions in which those reintroduced animals will survive. So it builds a movement. And then when those videos reach the news channels and they reach social media, of white storks being reintroduced in Sussex in this country, or beavers being reintroduced into the Cairngorms National Park, or those incredible videos from Spain of the Iberian lynx being released out of their boxes into the Andalusian landscape, they attract huge public attention. And so I think culturally, species reintroductions are incredibly important. That's why I was so excited to speak to you, Melpa, because what you're doing in Cyprus, restoring vultures, I think is absolutely at the vanguard of a whole movement that I see growing up in Cyprus now around harmony with nature and restoration. Melpa, are there any other species that you would like to see reintroduced to Cyprus as well as vultures? I mentioned earlier, for example, the Persian fallow deer, which I know is absent from the island. You know, I'd love to see those back. Is there any other species that you'd like to restore?
Well, the dipper maybe, because it was extinct due to the use of DDT a lot in the 50s and 60s. Also, the black vulture. I mean, it could be maybe in a 10 years or 20 years time, we could bring the black vulture back as well.
What you're doing is amazing, and I'm really grateful to have spent this time with you now. Thank you so much for joining me, and I hope to come and release some vultures with you sometime.
Thank you so much for having me. I will focus on what you said. You need to build the right conditions for these species to thrive, and that's the whole challenge. I will be thrilled to have you in Cyprus again and see more vultures and take you to the close to the cliffs in the areas that you can actually see vultures and admire them. And why not in a tagging or a release, for sure. Please do plan it, and we'll be happy to host you.
When I visited Cyprus, I was amazed at quite how much nature persists, in spite of all the tourism and development that's gone on. But Cyprus has big issues, not least the poaching of migrating birds. The return of vultures to the skies above Cyprus, though, is a cause for real optimism. Melpa and her team are doing incredible work. I urge you to visit them. If you've enjoyed this episode, I'd be very grateful if you'd give us a like or a review. Share this with your friends. It makes a big difference in getting the word out about these good news stories. In the next episode, I'm going to be talking to Andy Whitworth from OSA Conservation. Andy's a Brit living and working in Costa Rica, and specifically in the wilds of the OSA Peninsula on Costa Rica's Pacific coast, where he plans on reintroducing white-lipped peccaries, harpy eagles, giant anteaters, and so on, to a landscape that seems to get wilder with every passing year. Costa Rica is a pioneer in the restoration of forests and nature. I hope you'll join us.